From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The White House is awaiting investigations by Saudi Arabia and Turkey into the disappearance of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said he told President Trump to wait a few days before taking action. After meeting with the president and Pompeo, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin announced he won't attend a major investment conference in Saudi Arabia. The latest next.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is November 1st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. What a terrific night last night. Full house here at our Crawford Family Forum for the voter cram session. Make sure that you've got your sample ballot if you've received it yet, or at least some way to document what you hear next hour on Air Talk. We'll be playing for you in its entirety that voter cram session with our expert panel going one by one with California ballot propositions. Later this hour, we'll spend a little more time debating Proposition 11, which would allow the current law to continue that emergency medical technicians would be able on their breaks to still be on call, with a recent state Supreme Court ruling that would make it difficult for those employees to be called on while they're on their break or on their lunch. This initiative would supersede that. So we'll talk about that coming up later. But first, as you just heard on NPR's news at the top of the hour, the White House dealing with the fallout from the alleged killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the dissident Saudi journalist. Turkey has claimed that Saudi operatives on behalf of the Saudi government were responsible for killing Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and claim that they have proof that he was killed and his body dismembered. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo went to Saudi Arabia yesterday, spoke with the Crown Prince. Here's what Pompeo had to say at a news conference this morning at the White House.
I had a chance to brief the president on the travels that I returned from last evening, where I had traveled both to Riyadh and Ankara. Had a chance to talk with in Riyadh with the king, with the crown prince, with the foreign minister, all of the United States counterparts there. We made clear to them that we take this matter with respect to Mr. Khashoggi very seriously. They made clear to me that they too understand the serious nature of the disappearance of Mr. Khashoggi. They also assured me that they will conduct a complete, thorough investigation of all of the facts surrounding Mr. Khashoggi, and that they will do so in a timely fashion, and that this report itself will be transparent for everyone to see, to ask questions about, and to inquire with respect to its thoroughness. And I told President Trump this morning that we ought to give them a few more days to complete that, so that we too have a complete understanding of the facts surrounding that, at which point we can make decisions about how or if the United States should respond.
But of course, the dual investigations by Turkish authorities and by Saudi investigators, each of those nations has their own interests that are at play in this incident. With us, NPR White House reporter Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you for being with us today. First of all, describe for us a bit of the predicament in which the White House finds itself.
Well, the president is reluctant to sever ties or take any strong action against Saudi Arabia, a longtime U.S. ally and certainly an ally of Donald Trump. You might remember this president made his first foreign trip to Saudi Arabia, and he was certainly flattered by officials in the kingdom. They projected his face up on a giant hotel building there. He has been talking a lot about Saudi spending on U.S. military hardware, about Saudi Arabia's investments in businesses in this country. So he is reluctant to do anything that might jeopardize that alliance. And we heard Secretary Pompeo underscore that again this morning when he spoke to reporters outside the White House. and talked about the long strategic relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, a relationship that dates back to 1932. It's much bigger now than just a matter of Saudi's ability to open or close the oil taps. Their ties to the United States, their influence in this country is now much larger than just as a large energy supplier.
Well, and was the Secretary of State asked at all in the news conference today about whether the U.S. Should be an investigator of this because the two parties conducting it have their own particular biases that they bring to it?
He wasn't asked that question directly. Yesterday, President Trump was asked about the possibility of sending in the FBI to help in the investigation. The Secretary Pompeo was asked why, a somewhat skeptical reporter, I think, asked why Saudi Arabia should be conducting the investigation when it was inside their consulate that Mr. Khashoggi went missing. And if you accept the Turks' interpretation, it was the Saudi government that was responsible for his disappearance. So to some observers, it's odd that we should be waiting on Saudi Arabia to carry out an investigation when they are, in effect, a suspect in this disappearance. But that was what Secretary Pompeo called for. In fact, Secretary Pompeo's whole statement to reporters was kind of a holding pattern. It would seem to be just an appeal for patience. And what was odd is within minutes of Secretary Pompeo walking away, then we got news that the administration is actually taking some action here in that Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin announced that he will not participate in that big or what was going to be a big investment conference in Riyadh this coming week. The Davos in the desert, as it's been called, lots of business and media leaders had already pulled out. Up until this morning, the Treasury Secretary was still saying he was going to attend, but just before noontime Washington time today, he said no, he would pull out.
Well, and the challenge would seem to be that if the Saudi government comes back in the next few days with some sort of an account that U.S. officials don't believe is credible, it then puts the administration in the position of either having to accept an uncredible statement because, you know, of the U.S. ties with the Saudi government, or of having to go very directly against it and say that's total fabrication. It seems that in waiting, it sort of it sets up stakes that are perhaps even higher down the road.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine what the Saudis can say at this point that won't either contradict their original story, which is that Jamal Khashoggi walked out under his own power, even though there's no evidence of that. I mean, they've denied playing any role in his disappearance. There's been some reporting that they're trying to work on some kind of middle ground story where, okay, he was killed, but it was an accident. You know, there's certainly skepticism around that. And then the story that President Trump talked about earlier this week floated the sort of trial balloon that maybe was quote-unquote rogue killers, even though both the New York Times and the Washington Post have reported on what appear to be pretty extensive ties between the Saudi nationals who arrived in Istanbul the day that Mr. Khashoggi went missing and the royal family and, in particular, the Crown Prince. I mean, members of his own security detail that were in that group of Saudi nationals.
We're talking with Scott Horsley, NPR White House reporter. There's, of course, been significant criticism of Saudi Arabia coming not just from Democrats who've been critical of President Trump, his handling of this and what they say are the president's personal ties to Saudi Arabia, but also from Republicans. Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, Rubio has also been very outspoken about this. Scott, what's your sense of what Congress is waiting for here and what they potentially might do?
Well, you're hearing a lot of frustration from the president's fellow Republicans in Congress. You've heard Bob Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, complaining that he's not being given access to U.S. intelligence on this subject. As you mentioned, Marco Rubio has also been critical. While it is certainly true that the United States has a decades-old strategic alliance with Saudi Arabia, it's also true that President Trump, in particular, has a strong alliance with Saudi Arabia. He has very much taken Saudi Arabia's side in regional conflicts, not only with Iran, but even with Gulf neighbors like Qatar, which, of course, is home to a large U.S. military installation. But the Trump administration has very much thrown in its lot with Saudi Arabia in terms of both regional regional powers and economic powers. And so if there is going to be a rift, it will be it'll be a very difficult challenge for this administration to navigate.
Scott, as always, I appreciate your time so much. Very helpful for us to hear from you. I know it's a very busy day, like every other day for you, and thank you for joining us.
Happy with you, Larry. Thanks.
Appreciate it. NPR White House reporter Scott Horsley with us on Air Talk. Also joining us from the Wilson Center in Washington, Vice President for New Initiatives. He's been a frequent guest over many years with us on Air Talk, Aaron David Miller. Sir, thank you for joining us again.
Pleasure, Larry.
So, first of all, your thoughts on the best way for the administration to handle these allegations against the Saudi government?
First of all, the deeper problem is that the U.S.-Saudi relationship is out of control. Either a failed rendition or the premeditated murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And Jamal was supposed to come to the center as a fellow. I knew him. He put a premium on clarity and honesty. And that clarity and honesty obviously got him killed. The broader problem is that the Khashoggi's murder is just the tail end of a series of actions that Mohammed bin Salman, a guy who could be king of Saudi Arabia once the actual succession takes place for 50 years, has been a series of repressive acts at home, although there have been some significant reforms, as well as impulsive and reckless acts abroad. The temporary detention of the Lebanese Prime Minister, Saad Hariri, with his own hostage video, a boycott against Qatar, which has essentially increased Iranian influence with the Qataris, not diminished it, a disastrous war in Yemen, which both the Obama administration, but particularly the Trump administration, is enabling now with refueling and providing of non-dynamic targeting information to the Saudis. A rift with one of our key allies, Canadians, over the Canadian ambassador's criticism of Saudi Arabia's arrest of some of the leading women human rights activists who campaigned for one of the reforms that the Crown Prince did initiate, which is women driving. So the U.S.-Saudi relationship is important. We shouldn't abandon it, but it needs to be recalibrated. I mean, you can't have I won't call Saudi Arabia an ally. Let's call it a security partner. Allies usually share American values as well as interests. Saudi Arabia and U.S. do not share common values. And I think we, to some degree, have misjudged the Crown Prince. I think under the rubric of reform and perhaps he would, in fact, may emerge as someone who is capable of changing the kingdom. But it's masked a ruthlessness and a recklessness and a darker side, which has now involved the United States, its own values and interests. So I think we need to launch our own investigation. The Global Magnitsky Act, triggered by Congress, gives the administration 120 days to launch an investigation to determine whether or not foreign country X or leader Y was involved in the torture, murder, and violation of human rights of Jamal Khashoggi, and then determine whether sanctions are appropriate.
Well, and you've advised secretaries of states over multiple administrations in both parties. Hypothetically, if a U.S. investigation came back that the overwhelming evidence was that operatives of the Saudi government tortured and killed Khashoggi, then what should the U.S. do?
Well, the question is, if the Saudi story basically assumes that this operation was that the senior levels of the Saudi leadership, let's take King Salman out of it for a minute, but that the senior levels of the Saudi government had no foreknowledge of this, let alone orchestrated or validated it, then I suspect this administration would be hard-pressed to identify this as credible. If we came to our own indetermination, that, in fact, based on U.S. intelligence, investigations in Saudi Arabia and in Turkey, if at the end of the road, if we, in fact, believed that senior levels of the Saudi government, then you have to face the real conundrum of whether or not you're prepared to impose sanctions, freezing assets, suspending arms sales, certainly taking the United States military out of what has proven to be a disastrous campaign in Yemen. I'm not arguing that we abandoned this relationship. It's 70 years old, but I have to tell you something, Larry. Having worked for R&Ds and having voted for R&Ds, we've placated the Saudis, but we've also gotten things in return. And the reality is never have I seen an administration that has seemingly been prepared to give the Saudis so much room to maneuver, so much running room, and attach itself to policies that frankly are undermining our interests and our values. So we need to figure out a way to make the Saudis understand that there's got to be reciprocity.
Aaron David Miller, as always, thank you for being with us. Appreciate you sharing your thoughts about this and wish you a good day. Thank you.
Pleasure.
From the Wilson Center in Washington, Vice President for New Initiatives, Aaron David Miller, who was an advisor to secretaries of state in both Republican and Democratic administrations. Also my pleasure to have with us Henri Barkey. Professor Barkey is at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. He's professor of international relations. He's also an adjunct senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he served on the State Department policy planning staff just before the turn of this most recent century. Professor Barkey, good to have you with us today.
Thank you.
So your thoughts on the challenges that the administration faces in dealing with this, if the evidence is overwhelming that the Saudi government was responsible for the disappearance and death of Mr. Khashoggi?
Well, I mean, it's hard to add anything new to what Aaron David Miller has already said. I mean, he covered the whole gamut of issues. What I would say is, first of all, that the fact that Secretary Mnuchin is no longer going to Saudi Arabia for this conference is already an admission on the part of the U.S. government that, yes, Mr. Khashoggi did disappear in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. How he died and what happened, we do not know. It is quite possible that this was an interrogation gone bad. The guy, Mr. Khashoggi, may have a heart attack. Maybe they sedated him. God knows what the story is. But the fact is that he now clearly disappeared at the consulate, and therefore the United States will have to do something. And what's very clear from Mr. Pompeo's comments this morning is that U.S. is trying to give some time to the Saudis to find a reasonable explanation for what happened. That something maybe along the lines of what I just said, a heart attack and inexperienced interrogators who did not know what to do when the mishap happened. So they'll have to come up with some kind of story, which then probably this administration in Washington will back. It will back it because the relationship with Saudi Arabia is important for one reason that nobody else has yet mentioned, and that is oil. Saudi, after the United States, is the second largest producer of oil. It is really the central bank of oil in many, many respects. And you do not want any disruption. And this particular administration in Washington, the Trump administration, has been very vociferous about one thing. It actually wants the Saudis to produce more oil because oil supplies in the near future are going to decline because of sanctions coming in online against Iran and problems in Libya, but most importantly, serious problems in Venezuela where the government is collapsing, the oil industry is collapsing there. So Mr. Trump, in fact, a few weeks ago just sent a few kind of angry emails at the Saudi, tweets to the Saudi administration saying, where is the extra production that you promised? Because if the Saudis don't increase production, oil prices are going to increase. It's going to affect the inflation rate in this country. It's going to affect interest rates. And Trump is very, very sensitive, as we have seen, to all these. So there is another calculation going on here. that they need to manage the Saudis in such a way that there will not be disruptions in the oil market that will push the price of oil from essentially $80 a barrel to $100 or above.
And you think that's the risk? If the U.S. comes back with strong sanctions or severs ties with Saudi Arabia to any extent, you think the kingdom would retaliate with a constriction of oil production?
Well, retaliate is not exactly the word. First of all, any very, very severe U.S. action would create disruptions in the oil market because oil traders will automatically assume that there will be disruptions and therefore will push the price up. Right? Oil is a global commodity. It's the only commodity that is truly, truly global. So it's traders in Japan or in South America or United States who are going to push the price up in anticipation of disruptions, even if those disruptions are not necessarily intended by the Saudis. But you can imagine that if there were very harsh actions, that the Saudis will slow down their oil exports, and as the price goes up, they'll make up for the loss in oil production. With increased prices, so they would not come out as losers in this. That said, I don't expect the United States to sever relations with the Saudis. I think there will be very harsh condemnation. There may be the suspension of certain arms sales. And by the way, I think Trump has been exaggerating the $110 billion in arms sales. There is no $110 billion. If you look historically, the Saudis have never bought that much stuff from the United States. But nonetheless, they will have to do some. They will have to have some action that will be of consequence, because this is, in the end, quite a heinous act of killing a journalist. Even if he didn't like that journalist, even if that journalist had, from the Saudi perspective, had very dubious connections, whether he was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, etc. He was seen not maybe as a journalist, but a kind of an opponent of the regime. Nonetheless, it doesn't matter. You don't make somebody disappear in a consulate because, everybody's in danger in the future.
Professor, I need to break, but I want to thank you so much for being with us. That's Henri Barghi joining us, Lehigh University professor of international relations. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations as well, and served on the State Department policy planning staff from 1998 to 2000. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, and of course, continuing coverage of the disappearance of and presumed death of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Be on NPR News Magazine's All Things Considered and Morning Edition this week as well. Coming up in our second hour, it's our voter cram session. You'll hear it in its entirety in the 11 o'clock hour. Each and every ballot measure taken numerically, you can follow along and make notes to yourself as you decide how you want to vote. Coming up next, we'll debate Proposition 11. Take a bit more time on this. It has to do with emergency medical technicians and on-call status when they're taking a break or on their lunch or dinner breaks. We'll continue in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're on listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. A little bit later this hour, we'll talk about the familiar type of the gay best friend. We see it in movies and television shows. And an interesting piece just happened to read sort of takes issue with this, says, we're really past the period where the gay best friend serves a cultural purpose in entertainment. But what about in real life, too? We'll talk about that on Air Talk. But right now, it's Proposition 11 on your November 6th California ballot. This statewide proposition calls for those working as emergency medical technicians, emergency ambulance employees, that they would remain on call during their breaks from work. Now, this follows a California Supreme Court decision about limits on having workers on call during their break periods. The court essentially saying that those who are on a break or on a lunch or dinner period should not be on call. They are on their break. But historically, for ambulance employees, employees, they have been on call at all times, even when they break. Joining us to talk about the measure is the former director of the Los Angeles County Emergency Medical Services, Carol Meyer. Ms. Meyer, thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
So, first of all, would this change anything about the current practice for private ambulance employees?
No, Larry. And in fact, that's what we want. We don't want a change. Currently, fire departments, police departments, EMTs, paramedics, when there's a 911 call, even if they're on a break and they're the closest and it's an emergency, we want them to respond. Seconds can make the difference between life and death. And Prop 11 ensures that the closest ambulance can respond when a patient calls 911. It establishes into law the long-standing industry practice of paying private EMTs and paramedics to remain reachable during their work breaks in case of an emergency.
And we should,
as I said, just like firefighters and police.
Yeah, we should clarify that this applies to private ambulance companies because many cities these days contract with private ambulance services as opposed to having their own fire departments provide the paramedic and ambulance services. Also with us is Jason Brolini, who is a registered paramedic and has been so for 25 years, executive director of the United EMS Workers, which is an affiliate of the local of AFSCME, which represents nearly 4,000 private sector EMS workers in California. Mr. Brolini, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me today.
Why are you opposed to this proposition?
Well, first, let me say we're not opposed to anything that Director Meyer just said. And as a matter of fact, we're supportive of a legislative process to change the California labor law. We recognize that providing off-duty meal periods for a private sector industry that provides public safety services is not necessarily applicable. The reason why we're opposed to this is this initiative won't change the standing practice. It won't change the standing practices on training nor the mental health. What this initiative is about is having a liability protection clause at the very end to protect one provider, who's the author of this initiative, against the liability claims and potential exposure for civil lawsuits for alleged violations of the standing wage order. And that's why we're opposed.
So, so just clarify a little bit. So your concern is that one particular company that provides these ambulance services, that they're somehow fully indemnified against a lawsuit that they violated labor law? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. If you listen, if you read Section 889 of the initiative, it declares the on-duty meal periods as, in quote, declarative of and do not alter or amend California law and shall apply to any and all actions pending on or commenced after October 25 of 2017, alleging a violation of the California Code of Regulations. So this is an attempt not to increase public safety, and we agree that there needs to be changes and needs to be substantive changes. That's why we have an open committee process through both houses of our legislature. But this is about that particular clause and the liability protections that they're seeking.
Okay, so just to clarify, so you support the idea that private EMS employees should be on call during their breaks. You support them being on call. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And we actually co-sponsored a bill a few years ago to actually give that carve out to private sector, not only of the Augustus ruling, but of and to fundamentally change the wage order.
Why didn't that make its way then successfully through the legislature?
Because the author of this initiative was no longer willing to speak and collaborate with both labor committees in both houses and with other stakeholders when we were not willing to provide them this liability protection in the legislation that we were co-sponsoring.
Okay, let me go back then to Carol Meyer, former director, LA County Emergency Medical Services. How would you characterize the clause in the proposition that Mr. Brolini just referenced?
Well, basically, it makes no sense. It was good for all of us for 50 years. It's good for us going forward, and the union agrees with that. So based on a court decision, they're saying that for this brief period of time, it's not. And so the language that has been set forward in this proposition indicates that it's back to the time that the proposition was filed. And that's not unusual. Proposition 6 has a retroactive clause. There are several pieces of legislation this year that were approved in Sacramento that had retroactive clauses. So this is about public safety, and that's what we're all about as providers of EMS. We want to function the same way that the police departments do, the fire departments do. And in fact, many times there are contracts with counties where the private sector provides the transportation for the 911 call. And in some cases, they're even in the same station. And they would respond the same way as the firefighters in our current day. If this does not pass, if Prop 11 does not pass, the radios for the private EMTs and paramedics have to be shut off. And the fire department would get up and go on the call, and the EMTs would not.
Why did this not work its way through the legislature? Why are voters being asked to decide this labor issue?
Well, we believe it should have been resolved in the legislature, but the author never put AB 263 up for final vote. And in fact, the union was the sponsor of the item. They wanted the courts to make the decision and stated further that if the court did not rule in favor of banning all call breaks for private ambulance services, he would ban the practice through legislation.
All right. So you take issue with Mr. Brolini's characterization that the union supports the employees being on call during break?
No, we're glad they support it. We want them to support the bill in general.
Okay, but I'm confused because I thought you were saying that the legislation the union didn't support because they prefer to have the state Supreme Court decide that the employees couldn't be on call during breaks.
Well, they didn't put that forward, so you'd have to ask Mr. Brolini more about that. They were the sponsor, and it did not get pulled forward. It died in the legislature.
Jason Brolini, your response?
It actually did die in the legislature. It died in committee. Both labor committees and both houses wanted a very collaborative and joint effort on creating public policy that was good for all of the stakeholders. And the author of this initiative, AMR, as one of the larger stakeholders in the state, when they walked away from the table because we weren't able to negotiate the liability clauses that they were looking for, that collaborative process broke down, and there was a large portion of the industry that was no longer represented in those conversations.
What specific liability exposure do you want the private companies to potentially have?
So we were willing to allow them limited retrospective liability coverage and complete prospective immunity. We understand that the longstanding practice of having on-duty meal periods was because we provide a public safety. And so we identify that there needs to be some protections because we cannot have our employers and our providers and the county contractors litigated out of business. But we knew that there were three current pending cases. And as an individual, creating this group to create public policy was not willing to, by the stroke of a pen in the legislature, take away the civil rights to an individual or three individuals in the state to seek remedies through the civil process for grievances with their employer. We didn't want to add to any more lawsuits, but we didn't want them to be able to have complete shielding and get out of what they currently are.
But even if that would potentially expose these companies to ongoing limits on call employees during breaks, because couldn't those three past cases end up in that kind of a result?
That it very well could have. And it's not a process that I'm a part of. So we were willing to fast track
legislation through and continue working. Unfortunately, the author walked away from those negotiations and those discussions and qualified the initiative.
All right. I want to thank you both for being with us, talking about Proposition 11, which would require that EMS employees of private ambulance services be on call during their break periods. Carol Meyer, former director, L.A. County Emergency Medical Services. Jason Berlini, registered paramedic for 25 years of United EMS Workers, which is a local of AFSCME, the labor union. It's Air Talk on KPCC. We'll be back right after this live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. In the Netflix series Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, the character Titus Andromedon, played by actor-comedian Titus Burgess, often plays the role of gay best friend to the title character. In an episode from the show's first season, Titus is talking to an actor friend about seeing a straight coach in order to get booked for more straight roles.
Honestly, Titus, I was just like you. I was always getting typecast as the funny gay guy who works at the police station.
But that's not even a thing.
Or the sassy best friend who makes up words.
Like snobesity. It's when you don't know if someone's fat or not because they're wearing a winter coat.
But then I turned my career around. Thanks to Le Loop.
For realsies?
For realsingtons. He's tough, but last month I booked a radio ad for a paintball range.
The straightest of all weekend activities.
From Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, freelance writer Philip Ellis, when he was young, said it wasn't uncommon for people who found out he was gay to ask, oh, my God, will you be my gay best friend? And Ellis has continued to see this as an issue as well. He recently wrote an article, just because I'm gay doesn't mean I want to be your sidekick. Philip Ellis, thanks so much for joining us today on Air Talk.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry.
This really struck us as we were talking about the piece that you wrote, because this is, of course, a trope that we see over and over again. And some of us have actually heard from people that we know saying such things as, I need a gay friend, as though the person is a prop and their sexuality is what would be determinant over friendship. So as a gay man, what are your thoughts about how this is portrayed in media and how you've experienced this in your own life?
So, I mean, in my own life, I obviously growing up in the 90s. So when I sort of first started to come out, it was something that I came across because at the time, you know, we had shows like Sex and the City and Will and Grace, which, you know, that was the sort of gay representation you had on TV. And I think for that period, any kind of positive portrayal of a gay man on screens was seen as a good thing. But obviously, as the years have gone on and our conversations around gender and sexuality have become much more nuanced, we're still seeing this kind of very two-dimensional stereotype appear on screen. And it's worrying to me that, you know, I had those kind of encounters when I was a teenager, and it's sad to think that maybe there are still people who are internalizing that idea that a gay man is an accessory in 2018.
And do you think that it's life imitating art, or that the art is reflective of what really goes on in the world, that gay men are sort of cast in friendships in this sort of stereotypical role?
I mean, first of all, I want to say that obviously when it comes to the portrayal of, let's say, an effeminate gay man on TV, those things, you know, I think art and life imitate each other. There are wonderful men who behave like that, and that is just their truest self in real life. And I think two recent examples we've had have been Adam Rippon in the Winter Olympics and Jonathan Van Ness on Queer Eye. And I think when it comes to sort of being cast in a friendship role, I think that maybe there's a certain prudishness in media where they want to portray a more diverse array of people. But when it comes to people who are LGBTQ, they don't want to really address the sex part of the sexuality. So having them in that kind of neutered friendship role, they think that they can have their cake and eat it too.
We're talking with Philip Ellis, who's a freelance writer. He recently wrote the piece, Just Because I'm Gay Doesn't Mean I Want to Be Your Sidekick. It was in the Style and Culture blog, manrepeller.com. I'd like to hear your thoughts, if you're a gay man, about how this best friend stereotype plays out and what you've seen in your own personal life and whether this is something about which you have any resentment or concern. Do you feel like that the sort of stereotype of the gay best friend is eroding over time as we're sort of exposed to a wider range of people in our culture, in media? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're just about 10 minutes away from our voter cram session last night for a sold-out crowd at our Crawford Family Forum. Our panel of experts took all 11 California ballot propositions, boom, 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 one by one in numerical order. And if you had a chance to hear part of it, now you need to hear all of it. If you missed it, it's coming up in its entirety just a few minutes away here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about the so-called gay best friend or the sidekick role. One often sees it in films. You see it on situation comedies, on television. And as writer Philip Ellis describes in his experience, he often felt that he was sort of tempted to be cast into this role of the gay best friend of someone who's straight. What do you think about that? And is it a stereotype that you see eroding, or is there still a kind of an accessorizing, as Philip Ellis puts it, with straight people who have gay friends? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Philip, you know, at one point, it might have, in some American cultures, be considered edgy to have a gay friend before the degree of widespread acceptance that we have today. But given the fact that being LGBTQ is so mainstream, and, you know, certainly in urban America today, I would think that this kind of stereotype just naturally erodes. Are you seeing that?
I think you're absolutely right that sort of a gay man is not the the oddity almost that it might have been perceived to be by sort of mainstream culture a decade ago. I think maybe what where we're at now with trans people is maybe where we were with gay people at that time. I think maybe you're right that it's not sort of it's not like a huge sort of novelty, or I would at least hope not, in everyday life. But two of the biggest films that came out this year still had that stereotype in them. So Crazy Rich Asians and To All the Boys I've Loved Before, both romantic comedies, both, you know, quite rightly applauded for their representation of Asian characters. They both featured a gay man who exists to be an emotional sounding board and to give the main character a makeover. So it's still this stereotype that's being kind of pumped out into society by Hollywood.
All right. Philip Ellis with us on Air Talk. Mark in Hollywood, how do you experience this?
Well, I experienced it growing up and I still experience it today. I think the issue that I take is when, you know, I'm out with my group of friends, my safety net, when women try to infiltrate and it becomes an issue of consent. They'll immediately start acting a certain way, touching us a certain way, just because we're gay. And I think that is also symptomatic of, you know, how we were as kids. I mean, for me, I got bullied every day and I found safe. I found my safety net in women. And now that I've grown up, I have my safety net in my group of friends, which includes women. But when I'm out with my friends and I have multiple women just coming up and immediately, you know, grabbing or touching or, you know, interjecting into a private conversation.
What do you think is behind that? Is it they're trying to show that they're cool, or what do you think is the motivation for women to do what you're describing?
Well, like I said, I think as a child, I was searching for a safety net in a place where I didn't feel safe. Often when I'm at a club or out at a bar, my feeling is that maybe that comes from the same place that a woman is looking for a safety net.
And feel safe with you in this. So that's why that sort of physical affection would be shared. Mark, I appreciate you sharing your experience. Hans, in Eagle Rock, what's your experience of this?
Well, I think the movie Love, Simon shows that the strength of relationships between a gay character and his female friends has another side to it beside the stereotype. And I think for many gay men, the reality of close friendships, especially with women, has been crucial to showing the interconnections between sexism and homophobia, and has helped build necessary bonds that have helped in fighting both of them.
Hans, appreciate it. Boy, that's beautifully said. Appreciate it. To speaking to the importance of those friendships, those relationships. Podgy in Pasadena, you're on Air Talk.
I have experienced being the gay best friend over the years, you know, helping my girlfriends pick out dresses and doing the hairstyles and those kind of things is when I was younger. But over the years, I'm not sure if it's just that times have changed, but these friendships have evolved, and it doesn't really have the gay best friend ring to it. It's just that we're friends. You know, we're full fleshed out characters. We don't fall into being a little stereotype gay guy picking out the clothes. We don't do any of that.
Yeah.
And all of my friendships are very diverse at this point.
Podgy, thanks so much. Great calls. Loving this. Nick in Playa del Rey, your thoughts about this?
Hey, yeah. So I've had the gay best friend thing work both in my advantage and to my frustration. I did just want to point out that I've used it, for instance, freshman year of college to quickly make friends. I don't think it's a great thing, but I've relied on knowing that in a group of 10 or 20 people, if I establish myself as the a little bit more stereotypically friendly gay guy, like, I will most likely become a point of interest, and I may find an ally or a friend or, you know, a partner in a situation where I don't know anyone, so that's been great. But
it could limit you, I'm assuming, too.
Exactly, and when it becomes an assumption, it is frustrating. And I remember I actually started a YouTube channel called Not Your Gay Best Friend at the beginning of college. I didn't do anything with it, but it came from the frustration of, okay, I kind of went in, you know, made friends real quickly, and then I got really over, you know, falling into that obligation of being the gay best friend, which I'm really not. That, you know, I'm just not that guy.
Nick, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Terrific calls. Let me go back to our guest, Philip Ellis, who wrote the recent piece, Just Because I'm Gay Doesn't Mean I Want to Be Your Sidekick. Quick closing thought for us after hearing our listeners weigh in on this.
I really like that. I think almost every one of the callers spoke about that they have had really great friendships with women. And I do just want to reiterate that beyond the stereotype, the friendship between gay men and straight women can be a really, really lovely thing. And I just hope that, yeah, if you're, you know, if you're being a friend to an LGBT person in your life, just, you know, maybe don't say gay best friend.
All right. Yeah. Don't limit it. Yeah. Very good point. Philip, thank you for being with us. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much.
His piece was in the style and culture blog, manrepeller.com. Philip Ellis, writer, Just Because I'm Gay Doesn't Mean I Want to Be Your Sidekick, with us on Air Talk. Coming up next, it's our one-hour special that is being aired on public radio stations throughout California. It's our voter cram session, an entire hour, all 11 California ballot propositions. It's coming up right here on 89.3. KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Welcome to the 2018 Voter Cram Session from the California Dream Project. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles. The California Dream Project is a statewide media collaboration of the nonprofit news site CalMatters, KPBS San Diego, KQED San Francisco, Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, and KPCC in Los Angeles. During this hour, our political analysts and journalists will lead us through each statewide ballot proposition 1 through 12. We'll take them in numerical order so you can follow along on your sample ballot or make notes as we go. Our experts are Caltech Professor of Political Science Michael Alvarez, San Francisco Chronicle political reporter Melody Gutierrez, interim opinion editor of the Southern California News Group Salvador Rodriguez, NPR member station KQED politics reporter Katie Orr, and the director of Loyola Marymount University's Center for the Study of Los Angeles and LMU professor of political science Fernando Guerra. We are going to do this numerically to make it easier to follow, not based on necessarily what's most controversial or important, but we begin with the bond measure Proposition 1. This issues $4 billion in bonds for housing programs and for veterans' home loans. Who would like to start us on that one? Katie, you want to start us on Prop 1?
Sure. I can just tell you a little bit about why we're seeing it in the first place. In the fall of 2017, lawmakers were really dealing with affordable housing. It's sort of like the issue that has surged to the front of the political forefront in Sacramento. And so we saw several bills related to housing, and this is part of that effort, this bond measure that you'll be voting on in a couple weeks.
All right. Sal, you're a libertarian-minded person. As a fiscal conservative, you know, what are fiscal conservatives saying about the bond measures, even if they support the causes?
Yeah, so it's important to keep in mind that bonds are not free money. Bonds need to be repaid, and whenever you take a look at a bond amount, basically double it. That'll be the total cost to taxpayers in terms of you take it, you double it. Half of it is going to be the upfront money that the bond measures propose and call for. The other half is going to be interest payments on bonds. And so it's important to keep in mind that in a state that has hundreds of billions of dollars in unfunded liabilities as it is, that when you add additional debt, that has to be paid for somehow. And that's something that people have to keep in mind, is that this is not free money. Whatever the intentions of the bond measures are, you're going to end up spending twice as much that you're putting up front.
Well, a very important point you raise. The flip side is interest rates, at least for now, are still historically at a low level, even as they are continuing to rise, which does help a bit. Fernando, briefly, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Salvador is right about not only this proposition, but all the bond measures. But on the flip side, when you take out a mortgage, you basically double that amount. And why do you do that? It's because you're investing in your future and stability, and you need to have that infrastructure. And that's what we're doing here. And the decision really, I don't think, is necessarily about money, although you should take that into consideration. It's such a small percentage of what the California budget is. It's whether you believe in this investment and an investment that government should be making.
All right. Melody, quick thought on Prop 1.
Prop 1, I think absolutely this is a measure that will be interesting to see given the climate right now with housing. I think that will drive a lot of voters, with your heartstrings, so it'll be interesting to see.
As we've seen in Los Angeles City and County, where in recent years we've had two big measures, big ticket measures to help with homeless services, LA County's Measure H and the City of LA, Triple H, designed to create housing for homeless. Proposition 2 is a bond measure which takes some of the revenue from the so-called millionaires tax. This tax on high-income Californians to pay for mental health services. This provides $2 billion in bonds for preventive measures on homelessness and to provide housing. Michael, you want to start us on this?
Sure. This is another attempt by the state legislature. The legislature put this one on the ballot to try to deal with our housing affordability crisis that we have in California. It's a bit different than the general obligation kinds of bonds. It's a revenue bond in that there's already a dedicated stream of funding here. And so the funds to pay the bond back will come from the revenue that already exists.
And is there any controversy about taking money that was designed for mental health services and transferring that into a pool of money for housing?
Yeah, absolutely. Melody? That's even the road to get here. This is essentially a bill that was Senator Kevin De Leon's in 2016 and was challenged by a lawsuit saying, you know, that's not the intention of Prop 63, which is the money that is going to be used for this specific bond measure. And so there are people who are saying that you're taking money that is meant for mental health services and now creating a housing program out of it.
And for mental health
for
patients,
mental health.
Right?
Yeah.
And just remember, this was the millionaire tax that we passed, Proposition 63, back in 2004. This is not new money. This is just saying that money, we can now use $140 million of that money to build housing for mental health patients, right? And the other point I want to make is reiterate what Michael said, is that all these initiatives, they're either placed on the ballot by the state legislature or by signatures. And this is one that's placed by the state legislature to change a law that was already voted upon the voters that they cannot change. But they need your permission to be able to spend the money differently. Not new money, but to spend it differently.
Sal, you want to weigh in on this because it is a little different than Prop 1?
Well, there's the same issue that's at play, that this will ultimately cost close to $4 billion. Half of that will go towards these housing programs. The other half will go to interest. Now, one thing to think about is that that's over $1 billion that could have gone to mental health services that voters intended to go to mental health services that will instead go to pay off interest on a program that they did not originally support, and that money that was taxed from people, that's now money that's not going to go to mental health services. That's going to go to a brand new program with results that we don't yet know what that is. So I think that's something that has to be kept in mind, that this is something that's going to be – it's going to end up costing double what it is up front. It's a brand-new program. It's taking money away from services. And this is – the Mental Health Services Act has already been under fire for ever since it was passed by the state auditor, by the legislative analyst office. This money that's already being underused as it is. And so now do we want to take that money and waste half of it on – interest payments.
We're talking about Proposition 2, the bond measure, Melody?
Right. I would just jump in there and say absolutely there have been a lot of controversy over the spending of Prop 63, but I would add that the author of that measure, Daryl Steinberg, who's now the mayor of Sacramento, he said that it was always intended to create a program that stabilizes homeless, mentally ill homeless people.
All right. So that's Proposition 2. Next up, the third bond measure on the ballot, Proposition 3, which issues nearly $9 billion in bonds for water-related infrastructure and environmental projects. Who'd like to start us on that? Katie Orr?
Yeah, I can say if you think you voted on a water bond before, you have. This is about the third one. We had one in 2014 that was for $7 billion, and the governor came out very strong for that one. There was one in the spring that we voted on for $4 billion, and that was actually an effort by lawmakers to keep this proposition off of the ballot. They were trying to sort of do an end run around that, but they were not successful. This one would be for watershed treatment, habitat, groundwater management, a whole slew of different water projects. But it's not – we don't see the governor jumping in and supporting this one as we have in the past. There's a feeling that the government, the legislature and the government is not the ones backing this measure.
And do we know how much of this money would go to providing a more reliable source of agriculture water in California versus urban residential use? Has that been delineated to anyone's knowledge?
It seems like most of the water is for people are saying that one of the criticisms is that this is a giveaway to agriculture businesses and that they are the ones that would benefit most from this. And if specific water projects, water districts want money for their projects, then they should find a way to fund them. We shouldn't be making everyone in the state pay for projects that will only benefit specific places.
All right. Michael Alvarez, anything quickly to add?
Well, I think
that?
The other thing about this one is, and again, I spent the last couple of weeks reading through this and trying to figure out the details of how this money is going to be spent. And it's really unclear exactly what kind of transparency and oversight we as taxpayers will have with the expenditures under this measure. As I understand it, the money basically goes to agencies. State agencies are going to allocate the funds. And it's really not clear to me exactly how you track the money was one of the concerns I had with it.
All right, that's Proposition 3, nearly $9 billion, water-related infrastructure and environmental projects. The final bond measure is Proposition 4, $1.5 billion in bonds for children's hospitals. Melody, you have anything to say on that?
Yeah. I mean, this one is one of the ones that doesn't have a lot of opposition. It's funding cutting-edge technology for children's hospitals. That's probably a hard thing to run your opposition campaign on. But, you know, their argument is that they treat children from low-income families, they're not being subsidized for some of that care, and that this money is needed for seismic upgrades, equipment. You know, the one thing I would add is that if, like Katie said, if you feel like you've voted on this before, you have. There were two different bonds for similar improvements, $750 million bond in 2004 and a $980 million bond in 2008. So these are things that are going before voters, several times in the last couple
and
years.
And the retrofitting issue is a big thing for a lot of hospitals, I know, because just the cost of doing it to these large facilities is major. Sal, your thoughts on this bond measure?
So to take a stand against children's hospitals, this is one of those measures that sounds good. Who's anti-giving children's hospitals money? Well, I am. So this is $1.5 billion. This is going to end up costing double that. How about this is just an idea. How about the state, if children's hospital retrofitting is so important, how about the state just take some money out of its massive budget that it and the massive increases in revenue it has every year and put some money to children's hospitals retrofitting with existing revenues? They could do that if it wanted to. The state legislature could do that if they wanted to. Instead, we have this measure right here, which is $1.5 billion. That's going to be costing double that. It's going to be at the expense of taxpayers. And when I asked the president of the California Children's Hospital Association if this money was necessary, she said, yes, it would be nice to have. We do a great job of fundraising, but this would be nice and helpful.
All right. This is the 2018 voter cram session from the California Dream Project. Every statewide ballot measure, the pros and the cons, with our expert analysts and journalists. We'll be back with more conversation in 1 minute. This is the 2018 voter cram session. Heard on public radio stations throughout California, I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles. We're at KPCC's Crawford Family Forum, this hour devoted to looking at all the major aspects of each California ballot proposition. We're going in numerical order. If you joined us late, just want to let you know that the entire program is available online at kpcc.org. And you can also take part in the social media conversation about any of the ballot propositions. Just tweet with the hashtag CADREAM. That's for California Dream, this collaboration of nonprofit newsrooms, hashtag CADREAM on Twitter. Let me reintroduce our panelists in conversation. With us, KQED politics reporter Katie Orr, Southern California News Group interim opinion editor Salvador Rodriguez, San Francisco Chronicle political reporter Melody Gutierrez, Caltech Professor of Political Science Michael Alvarez, and Loyola Marymount Professor of Political Science Fernando Guerra. So we pick right up on the sample ballot with Proposition 5. Now, this revises the process for homeowners who are age 55 and up. Typically, if someone sells a house that they've had for a long period of time and they're paying their property taxes at the lower Prop 13 protected basis, they can at most get one exemption post 55 to move into another house that otherwise they'd be paying higher property taxes on because it resets. But instead, the basis of their old home is used. Not all counties accept that. It is a one-time dispensation. This, if passed, Proposition 5 would allow that to be used for as many home purchases as one makes. Post age 55, you take the lower basis with you, and would require that all California counties accept that lower Prop 13 protected tax basis. Sal, let me begin with you on this and get your thoughts on Proposition 5. Obviously, this benefits people that are age 55 and older, but is it too high a price to pay for that?
No, I would agree with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association that this is a measure that is completely consistent with the spirit of Proposition 13. It protects older taxpayers, older property owners, and it allows them to move without facing crippling increases in property taxes.
All right, Fernando, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, it's hard to be objective on this one. This is the continuing assault on the younger generation. It's the continuing transfer of wealth from the young to the older. It will negatively impact K through 12 schools. This is basically one generation telling the other, you don't vote, so we're going to take advantage of you. This is basically as bad as the Trump tax cuts were in terms of the impact that it has. And to me, it's almost an offensive type of initiative.
So what about the counter argument, though, Fernando, that this would lead to more older Californians moving more frequently? Because they only get one exemption that keeps people in place, that this would open up housing to younger buyers potentially because older homeowners wouldn't be so fearful of downsizing.
Okay, there's absolutely no – that's a great hypothesis. There's absolutely no data that actually occurs. And think about what we're talking about. We're talking about an older homeowner making $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 and on the sale of the home, and we still want to subsidize them to go and move somewhere else. That, to me, is ridiculous. I mean, yes, it might lead to maybe more people moving, but minuscule. The potential impact on the California budget in K through 12 is over $1 billion. By giving that $1 billion from children to older folks so they continue to enjoy a high standard of living.
Katie Orr.
Yeah, just to that point, I think that is one of the big concerns that cities and counties have is that they will lose out on a lot of tax revenue. And you see firefighters coming out against this, talking about how they're going to, you know, they'll lose property tax revenue. And, you know, if they lose property tax revenue, they'll probably look for other ways to make it up. So I don't know that we would necessarily, you know, citizens would feel the strain in other ways if they lost property tax revenue. The other thing to point out is that it's the realtors that are really backing this measure. And so there is some criticism that it's a play by realtors to get more business for them. So.
Of course, what may be in the best interest of realtors could conceivably also aid the housing market if, again, more people are willing to downsize, opening up properties that then would be reset for people under age 55 to the higher property tax basis. So, but I understand your point for now. There's no evidence that would it. Michael.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that again, this is one of these arguments about affordability. We have this housing affordability crisis in California. We'll talk about this later with some of the other ballot measures. I just really have trouble seeing how this is going to create supply. Right. When you think about the crisis is really a crisis of supply. We don't have enough housing. As I think Fernando said, it's not clear to me this is going to generate an additional amount of supply. And it's going to take about $1 billion a year away from cities and schools.
All right. Melody, a quick thought on this?
I think one of the interesting things is just that there is no revenue or income basis for this. And so I think there's a lot of effort to paint that this will affect grandma and grandpa, but you aren't looking at the income basis of who's going to be moving.
And Sal, quick final thought on this.
Yeah, so I appreciate the concern that's expressed about the revenue, the potential $1 billion in revenue loss a year. That's been argued by the California Teachers Association and other public sector unions that have opposed this on the grounds that it'll mean less money for them. I would love it if they had that same concern about the rising pension obligations every year that's hitting every community across the state, including the state government. You're talking about billions and billions of dollars of increases every single year to pay for a transfer of wealth from the younger to the older generations.
But the $1 billion number comes from the legislative analyst. Okay,
yes.
That's the legislative analyst, not anybody else. That's where that number comes from.
So that's Proposition 5 that we talked about for California homeowners age 55 and up who have a lower property tax basis under Prop 13. They would be able to keep that going forward with as many different purchases as they make of homes after age 55. Proposition 6 would repeal the gas tax here in California. This gas tax that was passed by the legislature to fund infrastructure, roads, streets, and now you've got this measure which would repeal it. Those who say that it's made gasoline prices too high, argument of some is that the state of California should come up with, from its own budget, with the money to do this kind of work. Katie, do you want to start us on this one? Because this also has a ripple effect, Republicans are hoping, on statewide office seekers.
Yeah, this is a measure that Republicans are really hoping will get their voters out to the polls. You see a lot of Republican candidates, gubernatorial candidate John Cox is really linking his campaign to this. You see a lot of the congressional candidates linking their campaigns to it. What we have seen, though, is that the donations for this proposition really peaked around the primaries and got people out. But however, they've kind of dropped off in the general election. So the ballot proposition is not getting as much support financially from Republicans as it had in the primary. However, you are starting to see ads coming out against it. There's a big coalition of groups, labor, cities, counties, government officials who are opposed to this proposition, and recent polls show it pretty far down.
All right. Melody.
Yeah, I'm just piggybacking on the polls. I think even your description of this ballot measure goes into the point that the proponents of this are saying, which is you would not know this is a repeal on gas taxes by reading the summary of it, which is eliminate certain road repair and transportation funding. That's become a huge part of the campaign and a lot of grumbling by the proponents of this who say that this was on purpose by the state to try to get this to pass. And I think you're seeing that in the polling numbers that essentially people are reading that and saying, well, I don't want that. But do they know essentially that it's repealing the gas tax? Is sort of the issue.
Michael Alvarez at Caltech, you do a lot of work in Orange County to try and understand the electorate there. What's your sense of Prop 6 and whether it's galvanized voters?
I think the evidence was pretty strong that this issue and the recall election that went on in Orange County in the primary did mobilize many Republican voters to get out to vote. I think it was something, and it's also something that the Republican running for Governor John Cox has been campaigning on. This is one of these kind of cynical attempts by politicians to use the initiative process in their electoral campaigns. And we've seen this in the past, and I know we'll see it in the future, because it's an effective tactic to get your voters out to the polls.
Yeah. Sal, you want to weigh in on Prop 6?
So the Southern California News Group originally endorsed Senate Bill 1 when it was proposed last year. Because we recognize, and I recognize, and I think most of us can recognize, that it's important to have adequate funding to pay for maintaining and taking care of transportation infrastructure. That's quite important. The issue with Senate Bill 1 was, one, a matter of process. The gas and vehicle registration fee increases were rammed through the legislature relatively quickly in a process that involved $1 billion in giveaways to buy votes, essentially, from various legislators, including Sabrina Cervantes, Richard Roth in the Inland Empire and elsewhere. But there's also a matter of the fact is that the state of California, one, has a profound amount of money. In the last seven, 8 years, the state budget has grown from $86 billion to nearly $140 billion. So it's not that the state doesn't have a significant influx of money coming in year after year after year. It's that the state does not prioritize its spending adequately. In a time where we are talking about something bizarre like the high-speed rail project, it's a nice idea, a fanciful idea, that's going to cost over $100 billion probably if it ever gets anywhere. Why is it that we're spending? Why is it that we have this significant increase in revenue? Why is it that we have pipe dreams like the high-speed rail project on the agenda, And yet we need to have a brand new source of funding for transportation infrastructure. That doesn't seem right to me. That seems like a money grab to help sustain an unsustainable fiscal trajectory.
Well, and Fernando Guerra, yeah. I've heard some people argue that it is a regressive tax because mm-hmm. people who often can't afford housing closer to work, drive longer right. distances, have less fuel-efficient cars. They pay more.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the major issues I have with this initiative is not actually the repeal, but then it handcuffs the legislature and California government for any future use of fuel taxes. And just the same thing that has happened with Proposition 13, which has handcuffed California to be proactive in a variety of different issues, this will handcuff us for generations to come in dealing with our road repairs. So it's not just a repeal. It further says that you can't do anything without two-thirds vote. It is, again, horrendous public policy problems. I agree with Michael and with Katie that it is a Republican ploy, and Democrats have done this historically as well, using the initiative process. Fortunately, in the last couple of elections, it's kind of died down. This is basically the only initiative that's really being done by a political party like that, where we used to have like four or five every year. But, Californians, we vote and love our taxes, man. Just in the last election, we voted all kinds, except don't tax our homes and don't tax our cars. That's the issue.
All right. Let's continue. That was Proposition 6, the repeal of the vehicle fee increases and the gas tax. Proposition 7 authorizes the California legislature to provide for permanent daylight saving time, but it would only happen if the federal government were to allow that. So this is a dependent proposition, so to speak. Katie, you want to start us on this one?
Well, as a relatively new mom, I feel like
it makes you an expert on this.
Yeah, the fewer time changes, the better. But I think you really laid it out. This is something that I feel like California has sort of had a fascination with. We saw it. There was a bill in the legislature this year, and that allows for this vote. But you really laid it out. What does this proposition do? Not much. I mean, it lets the legislature vote on it. If the legislature approves it, the governor could. Then it lets Congress work on it, and I believe the president has to weigh in as well. So, I mean, it is the start of a step of a process, but it really isn't anything that you'll see happen anytime soon.
Anybody else with anything quick to add? Michael?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think that this is we're already a couple steps in. As I recall the history of this, I believe that there have been the legislature's been interested in this in the past, and we're now at a point where they were waiting to see if other states were going to be interested in moving away from daylight savings time. And so I think the legislature's kind of hopeful that by getting the California voters to weigh in on this one and then they will act, that maybe that will lead to a larger group of states getting behind this effort.
And part of the challenge is our California Constitution, which is hundreds of pages long. We continue to put a lot of things in there, and this was decades ago that we did this. And so now we actually have to have you vote on it to allow the legislature and Congress to take action if it happens. So we're just asking you not to just give them permission in case there's a national trend to change this. By the way, the European Union and throughout the world, there's major discussion, and in Europe, they will change it next year, that we're getting rid of this. And it's consistent throughout the world, and we just want to continue with that.
There are concerns, historically, I should say, there have been concerns in the agricultural community about this, and because of the darkness when kids would be going to school, things like that. But Katie, are you aware of any sort of organized opposition to full-time daylight saving time?
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things that would be interesting to see if it gets out of California and goes to the federal government. Where would everyone come down on it? I honestly don't know. I do know, I will say, I used to live in Indiana, which had three time zones and was incredibly confusing. So we wouldn't be as bad as some places. But I don't know how the federal government would take to this.
Yeah, of course, our neighbor Arizona doesn't go on daylight saving time, so they have a permanent permanent time, but it's not daylight saving time. It's a standard time that they keep year-round. So once again, that is Proposition 7, which, if passed by voters, then would allow the legislature and the governor to take this up if the federal government were to make a move towards standardizing full-time daylight saving time. Proposition 8... would require dialysis clinics, kidney dialysis clinics, to issue refunds to private insurance companies for revenue that they take in that's more than 15% profit from the service that they provide. This is a very complicated measure. I've just led recently a full-on debate on this, and I'm still trying to get my head around the complexities of this. But part of the history is the effort of Service Employees International Union to organize the employees at the two biggest dialysis companies, the chains that are here in California. Michael, you want to start us off on this
so
one?
You gave me the hardest
one. I was going to say,
Actually, you know, this one is...
I've known you the longest, I think. That's why I'm punishing you.
No, my evaluation of this is exactly what you just said, which is this one's incredibly complicated. I've gone, waded through this a number of times, and it reads as if it's an attempt to again, lower the cost or make dialysis treatment more affordable. But I do understand that there's a little bit of politics behind it, which I wonder if some of my colleagues might want to talk about, because I'm not quite as aware of the politics.
Melody, do you have some info on this to share?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the lesser-known initiatives. No doubt you've heard the radio ads, because $120 million is being spent on this one.
A lot of ads.
Mostly by the dialysis clinics, who have poured a lot of money. You know, you do have the backdrop of unionizing, and you have the backdrop of, you know, whether or not healthcare costs should be able to soar like they have been. And so there's a lot of in the background going on to this one, on top of the fact that it's just a very complicated measure.
So the proponents, their argument is that there would be a greater investment by these dialysis centers in patient care, because they're not going to want to pay these rebates to the private insurers for going above 15%. And since what they would pay their employees in the providing the services would count as expenses, that therefore they would be more likely to invest in that. Opponents say this might well lead to dialysis clinic closures. We'll continue on this proposition on our voter cram session. This is the 2018 voter cram session, heard on public radio stations throughout California. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Pasadena. We're at KPCC's Crawford Family Forum. This hour is devoted to looking at the pros and cons of California's 11 ballot measures. We're taking these in numerical order. Again, in case you joined us right in the middle of this broadcast, you can visit the website kpcc.org, and you'll be able to click on the link and hear the entirety of the broadcast. Also, if you'd like to take part in social media conversation around any of the ballot measures that we're talking about in this broadcast, please just use the hashtag CADREAM. That stands for California Dream, CA Dream, which is the collaboration of nonprofit news organizations, public radio stations in the state, and of Cal Matters. Let me reintroduce our panelists joining us from the Southern California News Group, which publishes a variety of newspapers in Southern California, the interim opinion editor, Salvador Rodriguez. Also from the San Francisco Chronicle, political reporter Melody Gutierrez, Caltech professor of political science Michael Alvarez, Loyola Marymount professor of political science Fernando Guerra, and KQED San Francisco politics reporter Katie Orr. We were just talking going into our break about Proposition 8, which requires private insurers be given rebates by dialysis centers if they go more than 15% above their direct costs for providing patient care for kidney dialysis. Now, the price is much, much lower for those who are in Medicare. This really targets the reimbursements that private insurers are making. Fernando?
Yes, again, very complicated. There's a lot that I like in this initiative. There's a lot that I hate in this initiative. It's basically two interest groups who couldn't resolve this issue in their private negotiations. They took it to the state legislature. They couldn't resolve it there, so now they're bringing it to you, except that they are giving you emotional arguments, not all the facts, because it is very complicated, and it is somewhat emotional. And when that happens, oftentimes we tend to vote no when we don't clearly understand it. To throw in some even more criticisms, not criticisms, but complexity is what you just mentioned, Larry, that I think it actually undermines the current situation, undermines the Affordable Care Act, and this would resolve some of that because it costs so much for insurers to cover dialysis that they don't want the pre-existing condition. So it plays into all of those national politics.
Salvador, you want to share any thoughts about this Proposition 8?
Sure. So, I mean, I don't know how many people here in the room are experts on the dialysis market. Something tells me there's not very many of us.
I wouldn't be surprised if there is someone here, but go right.
So on the economics of the dialysis market, when you have a fight between special interest groups like this and you're talking about a proposal to regulate an industry and particular components of the industry of an industry, is that something that we really need to be doing as voters? Is that something to do? If you don't feel like you know exactly what is at stake, you probably should vote no. This is probably not what the force of law should be used for micromanaging things like this. This is an abuse of the proposition process and an abuse of law.
All right. That's Proposition 8 requiring rebates from kidney dialysis centers to private insurers if they go above 15% margin on providing that service. Proposition 9 doesn't exist anymore. It would have carved California into three separate states. And the state Supreme Court said this proposition as written is not eligible to be on the California ballot. So no Proposition 9.
It doesn't mean we won't see it again in the future.
Oh, I'm sure we will see it again. It may not be three separate states.
Yes, okay.
Who knows how many states may be involved. So next up is Proposition 10. Now, this is the rent control measure you've heard a lot about. It repeals what's known as Costa-Hawkins, which puts limits on rent control measures that cities and counties can put on for unincorporated areas. So this means that newer construction would be covered by rent control. Melody?
Sure. One of the biggest areas that this would address is that single-family homes and condos could come under rent control. That's something that Costa-Hawkins says that cities could not pass. So this doesn't create rent control in these cities. This actually gives cities the options to expand the type of rent control that they have. Obviously, there's a backdrop of a housing market where people cannot afford to live in the communities in which they work or communities they've lived in for years. But surprisingly, it's not doing well in the polls. And I think that that's really interesting. It's not even doing well among renters. But there is an incredible heartbreaking story of people not being able to afford where they're at. But there's a lot of opposition arguments saying that if you create these availability of this kind of rent control, that essentially there won't be development, that developers will not build if they don't think that they can earn a profit.
There also is the argument that single-family homes that are in the rental market, if those are rent-controlled, then fewer people are going to be willing to rent out those houses. Let's say they inherited it from mom or dad and they turned it into a rental, that it won't be as financially advantageous for them to rent it out, so those homes would be sold, not part of the rental stock. Katie, more thoughts on this?
Well, I just think it's interesting, especially considering that it's not doing well in the polls, because when they were considering this in the legislature this year, it was one of the most contentious issues up there. I mean, supporters of repealing Costa-Hawkins flooded the halls of the Capitol chanting, and when things didn't go their way, they were very upset. So it's interesting that there's a group of people who support it very, very passionately, but apparently it's not transferring to the rest of the voters.
Fernando Guerra.
I think of this just as a local control measure. All this does, it says, we give it back to the cities. And so California right now has one law that it's one size fits all for the entire state. But what we need in Pasadena or Santa Monica is different than what we might need in Anaheim or Laguna Niguel or San Diego. This, all it does, it doesn't institute rent control at all. What it does, it gives it back to the city councils to determine on a case-by-case basis. And that's so really, from my perspective, it's a local control. Let the locals decide what is best for their communities.
Salvador.
Yeah, so this absolutely is. It's about local control. It's about giving localities the control to be completely irrational and shoot themselves in the foot. Rent control.
Do you support that or not?
No.
So you'd rather be shot by California then?
Not quite, but... You know, rent control is a beautiful idea. The rents are too damn high, and so what better than to cap the rate of increase in rents? That's nice. Keep rents low. That's a fascinating idea. You pick up an introductory economics textbook, you go to page one, and there you will see why rent control is an absolutely absurd idea. That it will significantly curtail housing production. Housing affordability, it will have the opposite effect that proponents hope it will. It will be great for the people who get into rent-controlled units. It'll be horrible for the vast number of people who never are able to get into a rent-controlled unit, who are never able to get into a new apartment or a new home that they can afford because the landlord pulled it from the market or they converted it to a condo or they did all kinds of different things to adjust.
Isn't this, though, similar to the argument over Prop 13 and particularly the proposition here, 5, in that there would be potentially fewer limits, if you accept that premise, fewer units that would be built. But for those individuals who might find themselves out on the street or would have to move a tremendous distance from their job or lose their job, that they would be protected. So if you make the argument that Prop 13 is good for older Californians because they're not displaced, why wouldn't that argument hold for rent control here?
So it'll be great for the people who are able to get who are in a rent control unit that is not then converted into a condo, or the people who are able to get into a rent controlled unit that was built, or get into a unit that was built and that is affordable. But we're not. So there's the seen and the unseen in every policy decision. What we'll see are the people who are in rent controlled units. What we won't see are all the homes that are not built. We're not going to see all the units that are not put on the market. We're not going to see, we're not going to see the market work like it should. Now, obviously, we want to see people be able to afford to live in California. The way to do that is not to impose artificial limits like through rent control. Instead, let's try to facilitate more housing construction, more housing development, not do artificial games like this. Just open an economics textbook, look at page one.
Sal is right about the economics textbooks and what it says, but I hate to pick on my economic colleague because they're actually worse at prediction than we political scientists. And so everything that's written in economics books.
Which is saying something.
So it's not really an economic issue. It's what Larry was talking about. It could be a social justice issue and what kind of state we want to live in.
All right, Michael?
I'll go back to where what I was talking about with respect to Props 1 and Props 2. I mean, what we're seeing here, I think, on the ballot, think about the ballot as a totality, is a lot of different efforts to try to grapple with this crisis of affordability in California. Here we're seeing an attempt to stabilize rents. In Props 1 and 2, we're seeing an effort to, probably put a few drops in the bucket of trying to build more housing to try to deal with the supply side of the problem. So we clearly need to grapple with it on both sides. Stabilization, I see, is a really good short-term fix if cities want to move in that direction. But they really do need to be careful about how they do it and try to balance it with building more supply.
All right. Let's move on and talk about Proposition 11. This would allow the status quo where private ambulance drivers, emergency medical technicians would be able to be on call when they're taking their meals or other breaks. Because as I understand it, and our experts will correct me if I've got this wrong, but it seems under new state law, new interpretation, potentially they could not be on call with the change in interpretation of state law. This would enable them to be on call. Katie, you want to start on this one?
Sure. Like you were saying, in 2016, the Supreme Court ruled that private security guards, when they were on a break, they were on a break. They couldn't be on call or anything like that. And so the ambulance, primarily the private ambulance industry, saw this and decided that they feel like it's only a matter of time before a similar ruling is applied to them. So they're trying to get out ahead of this, basically carve out a piece of the labor law saying that their employees can still receive calls while they are on breaks. It's similar to Prop 8 in that it's a really specific industry issue.
And why wouldn't they be able to lobby the legislature to carry this through? I'm curious this ends up as an initiative.
They tried. That's what happened,
the legislature
right?
They
went through the legislature, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's a private dispute. They didn't solve it privately. They took it to the legislature. They didn't solve it there. Now they're asking you to do it. Mm-hmm. And so now remember, why do we even have private ambulance drivers? It's because a lot of cities, not like Pasadena or Los Angeles, where we have our own paramedics, they contract out. And so our paramedics here in Pasadena or Los Angeles don't fall under this. They can be on call because they're public safety officers. But in cities that contract these ambulance services, those EMTs and ambulance drivers are not considered public safety. Even though they're doing exactly the same job, it's because they're from the private sector. That creates a challenge.
Well, and I'm curious why the legislature, there wouldn't be sympathetic members of the legislature who would carry it on behalf of the private ambulance industry. It's interesting that that didn't go anywhere.
Well, you might have, I mean, labor groups might be opposed to that, you know, if you're carving out
slippery slope.
Right, and
yeah.
If you're carving out a part of the labor law, you know, yeah, it might not get far.
That's a logical argument that they'd be concerned. Well, if they deal with ambulance drivers, then who might be next? That's Proposition 11. And are labor unions, do you know, Melody, have they come out against this or not? I don't think I've seen.
For some odd reason, I know that the California Teachers Association is against this.
Really?
Why? I don't know. I just read that somewhere.
Teachers are always on call, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So that's Proposition 11. The final measure on your California ballot is Proposition 12. Supporters of 12 say it is a natural extension of Proposition 2, which was passed a decade ago and put new space requirements on egg-laying hens, on pork, as well as on calves that are being raised for veal. And they say, the proponents of it, that this guarantees even more space for those animals than was in Proposition 2. The opponents of Proposition 2 say this is largely the work of a major egg supplier in California's Central Valley, and that they actually want to have smaller cages in which to have the egg-laying hens. Melody, do you want to start us on Prop 12?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a ballot measure that you would normally think that animal welfare groups would all jump on board, and they're not. And the argument is that the amount of space currently under law for says that an egg-laying hen has to be able to stand up, turn around, and lay down. Now, what does that constitute? Like, what is the exact specs of that cage in which a hen can do that, or a breeding pig, or a calf? And so this ballot measure essentially is creating those specs, but animal welfare groups like PETA say, well, you know, we don't agree with that space, and that was never the intention of voters to give them that little of space. And so Humane Society says this is good. PETA and some other groups also say that are saying that this is going to give them actually less room, and that you would be doing more for animals by not voting for this.
So, and you have major environmental groups, Sierra Club's in favor of this, and I believe the Natural Resources mm-hmm. Defense Council. But as you say, animal welfare organizations, there is a split. The Humane Society of the U.S., one of the big sponsors of this, as they were of Proposition 2, which was passed by California voters. Katie, anything to add on this?
Well, I think it's one of those examples when it is a tricky measure. You know, I mean, you see this and you think, oh, you know, I feel like animals should have space. But then you get into the intricacies, and I think that's a lot of times the problem we have with governing by proposition, right? You don't know all the details that you really need to know.
Sal, your thoughts on Prop 12?
Yeah, so we're in a situation here with Prop 12 where the animal welfare groups can't decide if this actually enhances animal welfare. You have some that say yes. You have others that say you have like PETA, that's very strongly against it. I would just humbly recommend that if there's a measure on the ballot that you can't wrap your head around, that even animal welfare groups, they can't decide if this actually enhances animal welfare, perhaps vote no. Perhaps this can be resolved another way. Perhaps we can have a more deliberative process rather than have something as convoluted as this.
Well, I have to say, for all of us on the panel, I think, you know, all of us get asked a lot by friends and family members, what about this ballot proposition? What about that one? And so often, I just speaking for myself, I don't know about the rest of you, I have to say, you know, I've read about it, I've hosted debates on it, I've immersed myself on it, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around all the different moving pieces to it.
Yeah, Larry, so many of these are complicated. You should do what I do. I just tell every other person yes or no, and that way it balances out.
It's randomized.
And then you don't sack the deck. Hey, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate on this statewide broadcast, we appreciate your joining us. For our 2018 voter cram session, our panelists, Loyola Marymount, Professor of Political Science, Fernando Guerra, KQED politics reporter, Katie Orr, Southern California News Group Interim Opinion Editor Salvador Rodriguez, San Francisco Chronicle Political Reporter Melody Gutierrez, and Caltech Professor of Political Science Michael Alvarez. The 2018 Voter Cram Session is part of the California Dream Project, a statewide media collaboration of KPBS, KQED, KPCC, Capital Public Radio, and the nonprofit news organization Cal Matters. The project gets support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the James Irvine Foundation. Keep the discussion going on Twitter. Use the hashtag CADREAM for California Dream. For the 2018 Voter Cram Session, I'm Larry Mantle of KPCC Los Angeles.